Hi. Okay, Jerry Vogler.
I was invited to give a talk at the Steamboat Museum at the end of the month. And it's for an astronomy evening, and I thought I actually need to have a broader theme. So please excuse me for I have sinned. You are my test case. I have a brand new talk that I have never given, but should be okay. And it's about water in the universe. Now, water is everywhere. It may even be in this room. So as I'm giving my talk, try to look at something with water in it and think about the significance of what I'm saying.
So,
yeah, we've
got the yes. Well, there was a secondary thought. Oh, wait a minute. First of all, I'd like to welcome any members of the Ohio State University Alumni Association here.
Go Bucks!
Okay. This counts as an academic activity of the alumni fund. Whenever two or more alumni are gathered, it's an academic activity. This is an academic talk. Please keep that in mind. Are you the vice president?
Yes.
What's your name?
Bailey.
Bailey, let's talk now.
Okay.
Any members of my classes here? Any of my current students? Okay, thank you, Mackenzie and Audrey. Any former students here? Okay, good, good, good. Okay, keep your hands up. All right. So, water in the universe. Water, water everywhere, and there are many drops to drink.
It's a matter of fact.
It's hard not to have water. So water is a very simple molecule. An oxygen, two hydrogens. This is one. Are there any chemists here? Biologists? Yeah. So, very simple. Oh, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, just a second here. There you go. Okay.
So, very simple molecules, oxygen, two hydrogens, they're at an angle of about 104 degrees. The oxygen is very, very heavy. It has an atomic weight of 18, and each hydrogen is typically one. So imagine a bowling ball with a couple of golf balls attached with string. That's what a water molecule is. And of course, most of the action, most of the mass is in the middle, and the electrons are shared with bonds. And it's water when it's in a liquid or a solid phase. There are more interactions between molecules when it's in a gas phase, and they're pretty free to move around each other. So we find water here. That's good. Some in this room. There's some water here. There's some water here. There's some water here in the Orion Nebula. There's water in other galaxies, in the Andromeda Galaxy. And even in the days of yore, the ancient Greeks, the ancient civilizations, often thought about water in their constellations. And when you're thinking of the firmament, then water was considered one of the four basic elements. Not an element, not one of the basic four, but it was at least a philosophical start. So there are 88 constellations in the sky, according to the International Astronomical Union. Every culture has its own. There are Chinese, Indian, various Native American ones, African ones, Viking one. We use the ancient Greek constellations. They knew 48 because they could only see down to a certain, we call it declinations, like a cosmic latitude. So they could see the northern two-thirds of the sky from Greece and North Africa. We added some modern ones when we tried to regularize the sky. Out of these 88 constellations, about 21 have something to do with water. So there are four in the zodiac, Aquarius, Cancer, Capricornus, and Pisces. There are nine animals. There's a whale sea monster, a swan, a dolphin, a dorado, which is a type of fish, Grus the crane, they live around water. Hydra and Hydrus are female and male water snakes. Pisces austrinus is the southern fish. And then Volans, which is the flying fish. And then there are six sort of ship-type things. There's Carina, the keel. There's a big ship that was called Argo. It was a giant constellation. Then myth of Jason and the Argonauts was so big, it was broken up into four constellations. So now we have the keel, we have the poop deck, yes, but that was four. We have Vela the sail. Then we have the Pyxis, which is the compass for the ship. We have sextants, which is an instrument that mariners use to measure their latitude. And then we have telescopium, which arguably is a maritime instrument. And we have a couple of other things. We have a river. It's a river runs through it. And a crater, which is not a crater. Crater is a cup. So, and if you look in the sky, it looks sort of cup-shaped. Now, I looked up how these constellations, they have various things that are similar. And actually, I wonder how much they communicated, because some of them are quite parallel, some of them are not. So, Crooked Running Water, I actually have one now, it's the Cuyahoga River. We had that sea rock, the flying fishes like Bolans, the southern boats like Carina. Crooked Running Water might be Eridanus, and then I don't know if you can see a mountain. In the firmament, though, the ancients had their model of the universe. The earth and water were here, then fire, then the moon and the planets, and then the firmament, which was some sort of crystalline sphere. That was the ancient idea of the sky. So they had some idea, but they weren't quite sure what to do while water was down here on earth, but they also put constellations up on the sky. So I'm going to show you a few pictures of water constellations from a book called Urania's Mirror. Published at the beginning of the 19th century and designed by a school teacher. Any school teachers here? God bless you. And you too can make a book like this. So this is there's a box of cards. This is the cover for the box. And back then, we were long on artistry and perhaps a bit less accurate on some of the science. So here are three of the zodiac signs. Capricornus, you see Aquarius, and actually Eridanus comes somewhere this way. It's Capricornus. They tend to be lumped together. This constellation was a ball, a balloon. It no longer exists. So constellations can come and go. This is Pisces, just under Pegasus. And then it's on top of Cetus. It's almost like there's a cosmic ocean up there with the beauty. So this is Cetus. Now, I've heard of Cetus the whale. This is just some sort of sea monster. Eridanus here again. I have no idea why this is here, because I don't quite think that's big enough. It's too far south. But there's also Aquarius over here, so they tend to be clumped together. The dolphinfish are down this way. So, in the ancient world, the constellations actually did relate to each other a little bit. We have a dolphin, Delphinus, by Willa the Eagle, and by Sagittarius, this is the galactic center. You can make your way around the artwork and see the stars, and then Capricornus again. So, all of these things, it's almost like there's a cosmic ocean up there. This is the Hino water snake, which is very, very big. Hydrus, the male water snake, is in the south, which is a little bitty thing. And so then you still see some related constellation. This is a piece of the ship Argo. I think this is Carina. I have to go check. Lupus Centaurus. Argonaut, this is basically part of Argo. And then the compass, Pyxis, is here. So that's the artsy part of this talk. Now, let's talk about the science. Where does water come from? There's some chairs in here. Water comes from oxygen and hydrogen. Hydrogen is the most common element in the universe. 90% by number, or 70% by mass, of all atoms in the universe are hydrogen. In the sun, it's a teeny bit less than 1%. Now, the sun is very hot. The coolest part of the sun is the part you see. It's called the photosphere. It's about 5,000, 6,000 Kelvin or Celsius. It doesn't matter. It's too hot for molecules. The springs will drop off the bowling balls and let the golf balls go free. So although the sun has a lot of material in water, it has no water because it's too hot. But if all the hydrogen were joined up, if all the oxygen were joined up with hydrogen, there would be enough water to make over 11 Jupiters or over 3,400 Earths. It's quite a bit. Now, the sun was formed from a big cloud of stuff, gas and dust. And it had a composition, and this was about the composition. It was about 90% hydrogen by number, 70% hydrogen by mass, a little under 1% oxygen. Carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen are the three most common elements after hydrogen and helium. So we're actually lucky that the stuff for water is there, even though the sun itself doesn't have any. But the stuff that made the sun allowed for lots and lots of water, and the cloud the sun was made from was easily 100 times the mass of the sun or more. But forming a star is a very, very, very inefficient, sloppy process. We have a lot of stuff that doesn't get turned into star. Now, on Earth, we're actually quite lucky because we have water in three different forms. We have solid, cold, say, liquid in the oceans, and vapor in the atmosphere. And there's more. Because we can tell from seismic waves that there are various layers inside of Earth, and one of them is consistent with a mineral called ringwoodite, which is named after a guy named Alan Ringwood in Australia, so it was named a few decades ago. This crystal is about a micron across. It's very, very tiny. A micron is a thousandth of a millimeter. So it's finer than a hair. A hair might be 10 to 100 microns, so much smaller than a human hair. But it's 1.5% water by weight or mass. And there's a lot of it. So what that means is about 400 miles down, there are 1 to 3 more oceans worth of water in our Earth. And we know that because of these crystals being carried up to the surface by magma. And we see water coming out from inside the Earth in the form of steam. There's some steam volcanoes around. So there's a ton of water on Earth, more than the oceans. Now, if we were to take all of the water in the oceans and make a ball out of it, this is about how big it would be. It's a very thin surface layer. It would be about 1,100 kilometers on a side. It's the 11-hour drive. What's an 11-hour drive? It's just shy of from here to D.C. Because I've done it. So you'd have a ball of water somewhere between here and D.C., and that would be all the water in the ocean. And that would be as high up as it is wide. So it'd be like a cube. There are objects in the solar system that are smaller than that are water-rich. So Earth got its water. We're not quite sure how. It could have been through asteroids or comets when it was forming, or after it formed, because it was a very hot, nasty place. We formed in a hot place where water's not in solid form. It's stuff mixed up all over the solar system. And so visitors from the outer solar system, which were frozen, surely came here and hit us. And we got our water one way or the other that way, either while we were forming and then it bubbled up, or after we formed and then it rained down on us. So, take you on a little tour of our solar system. Where's the water? Mercury and the Moon have essentially no atmosphere. They have a little bit of gas around them, but it doesn't really stay too long. They're essentially airless bodies. But there is evidence for water on both of them. And the reason why is because there are permanently shadowed regions, both the Moon and Mercury, at the poles, where if an object crashes in there, the water will sink. What's more, if an icy object crashes somewhere else on the Moon or Mercury, the water molecules will drift up, they'll sublimate, they'll turn directly from ice to gas, they'll hang around for a while, and then they'll come down where it's cold. And these shadow areas here. Now, water on either the Moon or Mercury is not going to be, you find a chunk of ice. It's going to be more like the soil has a 1 or 2% water content. But we should be able to work with that. And still, if you take water, you break apart the oxygen and hydrogen, you got breathable oxygen, and you have rocket fuel. So that's actually why NASA wants to go to the South Pole of the Moon, because the South Pole, just by geography, has more of these, they're called cold traps, than the North Pole. It's just more ice down here. So the Moon and Mercury, even though you wouldn't think it, have ice. What's more, Mercury has some evidence of some complex, okay, organic just means carbon-bearing molecules. Mercury has some carbon-bearing molecules. Where do they come from? Probably some comets that hit it. And if they hit in a cold place that doesn't get shadowed, or that doesn't get the sun, that's firmly shadowed, it'll stay. I'm a little surprised. I had a little gift stat here. Lost it. Okay. Venus and Mars. Now, Venus is the same mass as Earth, has the same gravity. After that, nothing's the same. It has a big atmosphere. It's like me, down about 1,000 meters in the ocean. 100 atmospheres, and it's hotter than a pizza oven. However, we think that it had water, and the reason why is because it has much more deuterium than we would expect. Deuterium is heavy hydrogen. Normal hydrogen has one proton, one electron. Very simple atom. Heavy hydrogen has a proton and a neutron and an electron. It's twice as massive as hydrogen. Now, water, hydrogen is 1/9 of the mass. You have 2 hydrogens, 1 oxygen. If you have an oxygen, a heavy hydrogen, regular hydrogen, then it's 19 units instead of 18. It's about 5% heavier. We know what the deuterium content is in the sun, and in Jupiter it's about the same, and in Saturn it's about the same. We expect in our protosolar nebula, we had a certain percentage of heavy hydrogen, deuterium. Earth has about 0.1% deuterium. So for every 1,000 hydrogen atoms, one is deuterium. Venus has 1%. Venus has 10 times higher deuterium content than Earth does. Why? Because the lighter hydrogen is more likely to rise up in the atmosphere, break apart, the hydrogen will fly off into space, the oxygen will latch onto something, a rock or something. So what we think happened with Venus, it was very warm, the water evaporated, water is a greenhouse gas, we need it actually to keep warm, we would be about 30 degrees Celsius or about 60 degrees Fahrenheit colder without greenhouse gases, so we need some, we just need the right amount. So Venus had oceans, we think, they evaporated, that made it hotter and hotter, which accelerated the evaporation. Water went to the top of the atmosphere. It does not have a magnetic field like Earth does. So the magnetic field of Earth protects Earth from charged particles hitting the atmosphere and breaking apart atoms. Venus doesn't have that. Neither does Mars. So the water molecules broke apart at the top of the atmosphere of Venus. Hydrogen ran off into space. Oxygen came down, clamped onto something, and that was it. The water's gone. But the signature of the water with the deuterium is there. Mars also actually has extra deuterium. Mars lost water too, but there's still some left. It has what's called a runaway refrigerator effect rather than a runaway greenhouse effect. With Mars, what happened was it was cold and the water froze out of the atmosphere. That made it colder, which made more water freeze out of the atmosphere. And so on, in an accelerated way. And so there actually is a mixture of water and carbon dioxide in the South Pole, and the North Pole is just carbon dioxide. And then there's a subsurface layer of ice, which we can detect actually using remote sensing with the neutrons and the benefit of charged particles hitting the atoms in the surface of Mars. So we know where there are hydrogen atoms in soil. And it's basically at the high latitudes, and there's some other patches as well. If all the water melted on Mars, it would make a layer about 10 meters deep, 30 feet deep, something like that. It's enough to fill 2 Lake Michigans. So actually, Mars has quite a bit of water, but it's locked up in the form of subsurface ice. We also have evidence from meteorites chipped off Mars that travel here. We can find minerals in them that form in the presence of water. There's all sorts of complex chemistry. Also, we landed a probe called Mars Enix at the pole, near the North Pole, and it found liquid droplets of salt water. Now, the salt is very, 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 very salty. Mars is a very bad place. So the soil is basically toxic for Earth-type life. But the salt is concentrated enough that for a brief time, liquid water, salt water droplets can survive on Mars before they evaporate.
We are now preparing samples for return, and
I hope that we see more stuff in Martian rocks. We're moving out among the major planets, Jupiter has about 0.25% water in the atmosphere. We had a probe drop in the 90s of the Galileo probe, and it happened to go in a dry spot, but we have the Juno probe now, which looks at the microwaves, and it can detect where the water is. And so Jupiter has, within the errors, same amount of water as the nebula that made everything in our solar system. Same with Saturn. And by the way, Jupiter's composition is like this. The Sun's is too. Hydrogen, helium, and everything else. With Saturn, yeah, the atmosphere is about 0.25%. The rings are ice-coated particles. We don't know if they're ice all the way through. They might have some dirt in the middle, carbon, something like that. But they're extremely reflective, anywhere from marbles to maybe a beach ball, something like that. That's why they're so bright and reflective. And inside Saturn, and I suspect inside Jupiter too, although they didn't find the same model for it, we think Saturn is built like this. It's got a thick atmosphere. It gets warmer and warmer as you go down because the compression of gravity requires warm gas to push against it. So it gets warmer and warmer and warmer as you go. And same thing with Earth, by the way. You go down into the Earth, it gets warmer. You go into the middle of the Sun, it gets warmer. So bodies generally have warmer cores than outsides, because the outsides can radiate away the heat. So it has some molecular hydrogen, and then it has some insoluble helium insoluble layer, and metallic hydrogen, which is really weird. It's very compressed, and so the electrons flow, so you have hydrogen as a conductor. And inside that is some sort of core made out of ice and rock. That's our best estimate based on measurements made by the Cassini spacecraft and density. Saturn is very, very, very low density, so it doesn't have a lot of the same materials that Earth does. Earth is made, has an iron nickel core, and then basically sand on the outside. And Saturn has an icy, rocky core and a lot of gas.
I just want to put in a... Yeah? Well, Saturn also has a satellite.
Oh, yeah. A whole lot of them.
It has nitrogen atmospheres.
Out of all the moons in the solar system, I think only two. Many moons, I'll get to this in a minute. Many moons have a lot of water. I'd like to put in a plug for some planetary research here. So Dr. Tim Dowling, whom you may have heard, has spent nearly 40 years doing research on planetary atmospheres. He studied them all. I looked them up. Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Titan, you name it. He modeled the hexagon on Mars. And then there's a senior physics major named Brady Smith who worked on a project with Jupiter. These are ground-based images from a telescope in Hawaii. And looking in light absorbed by methane. And so there are something like 50,000 images. And he did a project to catalog them and make them useful to the scientific community. So moving farther out. Uranus and Neptune, now, the outer planets, the four of them, are called giant planets. Jupiter and Saturn are gas giants because they have a lot of gas. Uranus and Neptune are called ice giants because they're colder, they're smaller, so they don't have so much hydrogen and helium. They have some, but a bigger proportion of their mass is made up out of ices. Now, ices are simply solid forms of molecules which have low melting points. It's just going to be water, ammonia, and methane. So it's not just water, but water is one of the components. Uranus has water clouds, and over half of the radius, over half the mass is probably made of these ices of water, one of the components. And then there's a model for Neptune, they're pretty similar. Water has a very strange form, we think, in the middle of Uranus and Neptune. It's called super ionic. And so the way it works is this: we have solid liquid gas here. If you have solid, the ice is locked into a crystalline form, the molecules don't move too much with each other, with respect to each other. In liquid form, they slide past each other. They have a loose, they hold to each other loosely, so you have the water holding itself together, but not too tightly, so it changes form. And then in a gas, the molecules don't have too much attachment to each other. Superionic water only happens when you have a very high pressure and a very high temperature. So very high pressure means about 200 atmospheres minimum. And very high temperature is about 1,500 to 2,000 Kelvin, which is about 4,000 Fahrenheit. When you compress water like that, what happens is the oxygen atoms stay in place and the hydrogen atoms slide around. So what that means, the hydrogen atoms carry an electric charge. And so the material will conduct electricity. It's a solid with respect to the oxygen. It's a conductor metal with respect to the hydrogen, but normally the conductor, the electrons, move. This is the hydrogen atom. So the hydrogen atoms are moving around, the oxygen atoms are not. So it's a combination of a solid and a liquid. So that's what we think is down in. You have conducting water first with the hydrogen just sliding around, and then the superionic water is getting hotter and hotter and higher pressure. And a good chunk of both planets, of each planet, we think, is made of water. So those are the eight planets. Out of the eight planets, all of them either have or have had water. Now, small stuff, Watson and Jetson. Now, this is a video I was thinking of, So there's an object called Ceres. It used to be called an asteroid. Now we call it a dwarf planet because it's big enough, about the size of Texas. It's round. It orbits the sun, but it's not the biggest thing in its orbital area. So there are a lot of asteroids. There are hundreds of thousands of asteroids, millions, depending on how small you want to go. So Ceres is the biggest one, but it's not got the most mass in the belt. So, and just to give you an idea, this is Earth, Mars, and Ceres. So Ceres is pretty small stuff. We sent a probe there called the Dawn Probe from 2007 to 2018. It was a really neat mission because it had an experimental rocket engine called an ion drive. So Mr. Scott was right. Gartner had guessed ion drive. It's not exactly the same thing you might think, but it works. And for this little spacecraft, it was good because it fires for a long time. It has the thrust of the weight of the sheet of paper on your hand, but it'll fire for months and months and months and build up a high velocity. So it went to two asteroids, actually. It orbited Vesta, which is a dry asteroid, and Ceres, which is a wet one, because we saw signs of water vapor around Ceres with ground-based telescopes. And so this is a picture, a representation, false-color picture, from a crater called O'Connor, which has salty liquid residue here. Brine, salt water that evaporates, salt deposits are left behind. That can only happen when there was some sort of salty liquid that came there and then the water sublimated, went off to space. It has to be relatively recent as well, because over time, meteorites will create a kind of dirt on the asteroid and cover it up. So this is reasonably fresh. We think that the model is that it has some sort of icy mantle with clay. By the way, clay is made in the presence of water. This was a very wet asteroid, and there are icy deposits. This is the North Pole of Ceres, and you can see over the course of a day how there's some regions which just don't see, the sun doesn't shine there. So that's where water ice is likely to stay, just like on the moon and on Mercury. So Ceres is an interesting object. We think, actually, it did not form where it is. It's halfway between Jupiter and Mars. And it probably came from somewhere in the outer solar system because in the beginning, and this will be a subject for another talk, the early solar system was a chaotic place, and things got slung around all over the place. Planets changed orbits. We never would have thought this. 30 years ago, people would have said, you're crazy to think of that. Planets interact with each other slowly over the course of millions of years or longer. And the solar system was a crowded place, so things changed orbits. So Ceres came from somewhere farther out. There's another asteroid called Bennu. Now, so Sirius is the size of Texas. Bennu is the size of the University of Louisville campus or less. It's about here to here is a natural science building to the planetarium. So this is a really tiny thing. It's basically what's called a rock pile. It's loosely held together by gravity. We sent a mission there called OSIRIS-REx to get a sample return. And this is the sample, and we're supposed to get 60 grams. We got something like 100. We got a bumper crop. And what's 100 grams? 4 ounces. You could hold this in your hands probably. It's not much, but it costs hundreds of millions of dollars to get this. But this is pristine. This was opened under the cleanest conditions we could. So no earthly contamination. And the sample has water, nitrogen, carbon, ammonia, organic molecules, carbon. On this thing. And there are millions of objects like this. Hundreds of thousands. They could have brought the same materials to Earth after it cooled down. There's water on Ceres, the asteroid. There's water on this somewhat random asteroid. Now, let's talk about a few objects. There are hundreds of satellites in the solar system. Earth has one, Mars has two, Jupiter has a bunch, Saturn has more. There's a Neptune, Pluto. Some asteroids have satellites. Eris has a satellite. There are six giant ones. We have one, Jupiter has four, Saturn has one, and Neptune has one. Our moon has a little bit of water. One satellite of Jupiter is twisted and flexed so much, it has volcanoes, it's a horrible place, it's hot on the surface, actually. It probably doesn't have any water anymore, it may have had some that's idle. All the other giant satellites have a lot of ice, have a lot of water. They're probably about half ice, each of them. Not like Earth, not like the Moon. Half ice by mass. So this is one of them called Europa. It's this spiderweb network of cracks and then the red stuff. The red stuff is organic molecules we call folates. And then the surface appears to have been broken up and refrozen, like ice floes. We can work out the thickness of the ice from looking at the pattern of the elevations of the pieces, so it's probably about 10 millimeters thick, roughly speaking. So we have a model for it, where there's this icy crust, and then there's this liquid water ocean underneath, and the reason why is because the interior is twisted and flexed by tides from Jupiter and gravitational attraction from the other satellites. So it has a heat source in the middle, just like Jupiter's moon Io, Jupiter's moon Ganymede does too, possibly Callisto. So there are two probes on the way right now to Europa. One is called the Europa Clipper, and the other is called the Jupiter Icy Something Explorer. The Europa Clipper is NASA. The JUICE mission is European Space Agency. And the reason they're going here is because this has organics, this has liquid water, and a heat source. So it's got perhaps the best condition in the solar system for life. There's another one called Enceladus. It's also icy, but this is the size of Ohio. Europa is the size of our moon, which is about a quarter of the size of Earth. Enceladus is the size of the great state of Ohio, which is not very big, but it's got other nice things. It also has cracks in it, and we can see water vapor coming out of the cracks. In the bottom, it has something called tiger stripes. And so we had a probe there called the Cassini probe in the 2000s, so about 2016 or 17, something like that. And so it was not designed to go in and sample what was in these plumes. You can tell from the spectroscopy, okay, it's water. That's about it. It also has these organic molecules on the surface. It has liquid water underneath. It's close to Saturn. It's tidally twisted and flexed and heated. And it also is a great place for life. Now, there are other places, Titan, possibly Ganymede. There are a number of satellites like this, Triton, possibly, as well. Pluto, who knows? Pluto may have liquid water ocean, or at least it did. So it's crazy. Once you get out past what's called the snow line, the temperature of a planet depends on its distance from the sun. So Mercury is often hot, Venus would be hot, Earth would be about 30 Celsius, 60 Fahrenheit colder than it would be now in our atmosphere. Mars is like Antarctica. When you get to the asteroid belt, that's the dividing line when water vapor becomes solid and the sun is not intense, sunlight is not intense enough to evaporate. So inside the asteroid belt, no ice unless it's shielded underground, crater with shadows, something like that. Outside the asteroid belt, no problem. That's why you have all of these objects made out of solid water. Now let's talk about Pluto. Pluto is also a dwarf planet. This is Pluto compared to other moons in the solar system. So Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto belong to Jupiter. Titan belongs to Saturn. The moon belongs to us. Triton belongs to Neptune. And Pluto is smaller than Triton. It's a little thing. It's about the size of the western United States. Inside Pluto, well, on the surface of Pluto, first, we had one of the greatest missions I've seen in my life on the Pluto Express New Horizons. Flew by Pluto in 2015 on Bastille Day and took pictures going, psh! It had something like 6 hours to take all the pictures we could. It traveled. It was proposed in 1990 and rejected, proposed and rejected, proposed and rejected, accepted in 2000, built in 5 years, launched in 2005, and took 10 years to get to Pluto. 2015. It took 25 years, that's a good chunk of a scientist's career, to go from the first proposal to actually getting the pictures. And you can imagine now that the chief scientists for this mission hadn't retired, because they worked all the time. And there are people working on this team who were barely born when it was first proposed. So if you want to go into astronomy, if you want job security, go for a long-term space mission, outer solar system space mission. Just make sure that it gets in space, because it's very easy to cut the budget while it's on the ground. But once it's in space, it gets politically a little bit, I hope, more difficult. But anyway, on the surface of Pluto, we have a pretty good map now. Using remote sensing and looking at how basically neutrons bounce back, and when charged particles, high-energy charged particles hit the surface of Pluto, there are places with water ice, these blue areas. Now the rest of it, the solid nitrogen is 40 Kelvin. It's extremely cold. So nitrogen is solid. It's wacky. It has a nitrogen atmosphere which pops up in the Pluto summer, or when actually no, it pops up when Pluto's close to the sun as an elliptical orbit, and then it condenses and freezes when Pluto's farther from the sun. It has a very complex surface with an atmosphere and haze. We can see some red stuff as well. It has organics. Solids, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, those sorts of things, on Pluto. And its surface is relatively young. That means stuff is happening inside, melting and refreezing. And that's what tells us that at some time in the not too distant past, Pluto had things melting its surface. Now, could it have a liquid water ocean underneath? We need to go back. It has a giant moon called Charon, which is another dwarf planet. And the rotation, they're locked, so they present the same face toward each other. May still have a heating mechanism, it's hard to say. So I challenge all of you here to think about joining a Pluto mission, a second Pluto, an orbiter and a lander, and you'll have job security for a long, long time for science. Oh, this is at the moment, so yes. I don't think we'll get one funded next year. There are other
proposed heat mechanism of Pluto.
It would have to be tides. There's nothing else. There could be a little bit of radioactivity, but I don't think so. It's made of rock and ice. It's low density. It just doesn't have very much heavy stuff in it. It's a mystery, actually. So job security for Pluto mission. Okay. There are also lots of little things. Talk about asteroids, comets. How many of you have seen a comet? Okay. They come by. Usually there's one plus or minus one a year. Often you need to look at binoculars. We've had some really good ones, but they don't happen every year. I hope that we get another good one sometime soon. They are basically icy, dirty styrofoam that, when it's out in space, far from the sun, it's just sitting there, and it's black as coal. It reflects a few percent of the light that hits it. They're dark. When they get close to the sun, that compounds which have low melting points, like water, methane, ammonia, stuff like that, they evaporate, and they come out of the inside, they bubble up, they're like geysers. They're little jets, and it forms an atmosphere called the coma. It can be up to the size of Saturn. The nucleus is the size of a few miles across, basically. Less than the size of Jefferson County or the city of Louisville. A few times the size of the University of Louisville campus. And then, because they're made out of dirty, dusty, wet styrofoam, as they're evaporating, they leave behind a trail of dust just like pig pen in peanuts. And this dust, and they also give off their geysers gas. So they have dust and gas, and actually they can sometimes have two tails, dust and gas. And we can see all sorts of low melting point compounds like water, ammonia, and methane inside of them. So comets definitely have water. We've known about that for a long time. So the nucleus, again, is just this little thing a few miles across. It's irregular. It might be shaped like a potato or a peanut. And the good thing is they're deep freeze samples from the outer solar system. So they didn't change much since 4 billion years ago and so 4.5 billion years ago when the solar system formed. Comets, because of their orbits, they're very cigar-shaped, they're very elliptical. They come from a long way away. The close ones come from somewhere past Jupiter, because Jupiter affects them and changes their orbits. Or the Kuiper Belt, which is like a donut or bagel outside the orbit of Neptune. It goes from the orbit of Neptune to twice the orbit of Neptune. So think of a bagel. And that little bagel is just the thing here. Then we have a big spherical distribution of little things around the sun that goes out to a light year or so called the Oort cloud. And there are some long period comets that come in from the Oort cloud. They just fall into the sun, they fall back out. They're very close to interstellar. We probably have some comets from neighboring stars too, and some of our comets probably have gone off to neighboring stars as well. So these are deep freeze samples from the early solar system, and they have water. So we have sent a number of probes to comets to either take pictures or sample their dust, or even to land on them. Another one of the greatest missions I've seen in my life was a European Space Agency mission called Rosetta to land on a comet. Now you might think, how do you land on a comet? The answer is with great difficulty. The problem is, the gravity is so small that if you were to stand on a comet and do this, you'd go off into space. Their gravity is so low, so they had to devise a harpoon to anchor themselves, but it didn't work. And so they landed on a comet, the harpoon didn't work, and it bounced a couple times, and the lander, it had an orbiter, and the lander landed on its side in some sort of crevasse. And then it didn't get sunlight, it ran on batteries for a day or two, and that was it. So they wanted to have it run for quite a while. They found lots of water and organic material, and it turns out, because we could be there with a little laboratory, we could measure the deuterium content of this comet. It's a nondescript comet called 67P, with a longer name, which I'm sure we all know the rest of the name called, 67P. And so the deuterium content of this comet is actually like the deuterium content on Earth. We think that Earth's water could have come from comets, could have come from asteroids. This is actually recent because we used to think that it wasn't the case, that it was asteroids. 2024 result. We revised the effects of cometary dust, so we could have got our water from comets as well. So here's a picture of the comet. It's blacker than coal. It does not look anything like, say, a Ceres with nice ice on the crater or something. It's just black junk, but the water's inside and it evaporates very quickly when it gets close to the sun. It's shaped like a rubber duck. It has all sorts of geysers on it. It would float if you put it in the ocean. And it's full of organics and water ice, and it's got holes, it's porous. Interesting object. This could be a whole topic of another talk. Okay, so that's it for our solar system. What about outside our solar system? Well, I would love to put a picture of an exoplanet. Basically, if we have a picture of an exoplanet, it's a dot. We can tell the color. It's not terribly exciting. We tell about exoplanets' masses and radii and work out their densities from indirectly looking at what they do to their stars, how their stars wobble toward us and away from us, or the planet transits in front of a star, something like that. So I'm putting pictures of our solar system planets, and these are real. So we found a couple of water worlds, and I will, since this is a pretty good video, I'm going to play this. The second one is less exciting, but let's see if we can do this. This work. Going. Maybe not. Okay, I want to go back to the slideshow. How do I go back to the slideshow?
Well, not all, but
three fingers
up.
Yeah. Oh, there it is. Okay, good. All right. We found evidence of water and exoplanets by looking at spectroscopy. As they pass in front of their star, the light goes through the planet's atmosphere, and we find water. More than one, actually. It's pretty common. There's the steam worlds. There are planets whose densities are about the same as water. They're not made mostly of rock. They're not made mostly of gas. Be like a giant version of Europa. Out in space, in gas clouds, is the Orion Nebula. We also find water. We use spectroscopy to spread out light in its wave, different wavelengths, and look for little dips and features in the spectrum. Find water. And we find water in gas clouds all over the place. There are places called giant molecular clouds. These are the birthplaces of stars in our own galaxy, in spiral arms, in the disk. They are the coldest is colder than Pluto. Pluto's 40 Kelvin, it's 10 to 40 Kelvin. And they're the densest parts of interstellar space. So you call it a cloud, yeah, it's 1/1,000,000,000 of our atmosphere, so don't go there and expect to have any pressure. And there's dust there. We find all sorts of molecules, including organic molecules, amino acids, that sort of thing. Well, here's a cutout of the Orion Nebula. It has layers. There are some bright stars here that formed, and they are basically heating up the gas around them and making it glow. And then there's a very dense part in the middle, and that's where there are some extremely dense places. This is a half a parsec, is about 1.5 light years. So it's a stellar nursery. And stars are forming in here. This is a picture in optical light from the Hubble Space Telescope. This is infrared, which passes through the dust. And you can see, actually, this area has dust, corresponds to dust. The bluish areas have dust because it's reflected from a sideways star. The black area is dust in front of another star. It's a very interesting place, and it's one of the favorite objects of amateur astronomers as well. Very beautiful. How do we observe these? Many molecules have transitions in microwaves and radio waves, so we use microwave and radio telescopes. There's something called the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, which is a billion-dollar international observatory, Canada, European Space Agency, or European Southern Observatory, U.S., Japan, South Korea, and so on. And so it has a bunch of telescopes that are hooked up, and it has super-duper resolution much better than the Hubble. We have ground-based millimeter and radio telescopes as well. This was in the dish, which I highly recommend that you see, but I've heard it's very good. And then we had a small infrared telescope in space called Herschel, and we have currently the James Webb, which is an infrared telescope, which is fantastic for detecting molecules in space. Now, here's all the water, and by the way, we find water in other galaxies too, I said at the beginning of it. Main galaxies till the cows come home. Where do elements come from right now? Hydrogen, oxygen? The hydrogen came from the Big Bang 13 and 13.5 billion years ago. There are two kinds of hydrogen. There's regular hydrogen, proton and electron. There's heavy hydrogen, deuterium. That was made in the Big Bang too. And is easily destroyed in stars. There's another kind of hydrogen that only lasts for about 10 minutes. A couple kinds of helium as well. Those are all made in the Big Bang, and the vast majority of helium in the universe now was made in the Big Bang. Stars make a little bit, but it's not a lot. Stars are giant nuclear reactors. Most of them, but main sequence stars turn hydrogen to helium in their core. And then after a while, then they finish. When the core becomes helium, then it takes a lot more, a lot higher temperature and higher pressure to turn helium into something like carbon. So the helium just sits there, and the outer layers of the star start to crush together from gravity, then it forms some a hydrogen shell fusing around the helium core, and that causes the star to swell up. Eventually, with many stars, the helium core will shrink down enough, with enough pressure and temperature, start fusing helium into carbon and oxygen. You take two heliums together, you make beryllium, but that's not stable and it falls apart. So you put three heliums together really fast, you got carbon, that will stay. You add another helium to that, you got oxygen. That's where the oxygen comes from. These red giants have a lot of convection. It's just like thunderstorms, which we'll have tonight. This convection will dredge up the carbon made in the core, bring it to the surface, and red giant stars are unstable. They pop off their outer layers into space. And so they pollute space with carbon. They're like old diesel trucks. Yeah. So you've got a core of carbon oxygen here. You've got some helium being made, carbon oxygen, hydrogen and helium to form layers like an onion. And then convection takes helium, carbon, oxygen, throws it out into space, and makes a cloud of gas around the star called the planetary nebula. And these giant stars, by the way, are very big. It's Horizon, Arcturus, Pollux, Sirius, and the sun is a dot, which is 1 pixel. That's how big these stars are. If you have Betelgeuse in our solar system, it would go somewhere between Jupiter and Uranus, depending on how you count. So this is where the carbon and oxygen go out into space, and there's hydrogen already out there. So that's why we have so much oxygen, or so much water in the universe. Pretty nebula with showing that there's a central star here, which is what's left of the red giant, the inner hot parts. And this is the cloud of gas and dust that is spewed out into space. And you can see actually the gas going out and going through some lumpy previous bits of gas that were spewed out. Now, there's another way to put lots of oxygen and carbon into interstellar space. Let's have a star blow up. Couple of ways to do that. Either a massive star can develop an onion structure, and eventually it will get an iron heart, and iron hearts don't generate any heat. Everybody knows that. And so then it'll just sit there, the fusion stops, gravity wins, it collapses, and then the iron starts to fall apart under the strain, and then turns into a ball of neutrons, the rest of the star bounces off that and blows up. The other way is there's a white dwarf, which is the burnt out remnant of the star, which steals some material from a companion, gets a little bit too much, and then collapses and blows up. Either way, you put oxygen into the interstellar medium, especially from the first kind, the neutron star, massive star, supernova. So, in our universe on average, oxygen is on the order of 1% of stuff by mass, mostly made from heavy star supernovae, some from white dwarf supernovae, some from red giants. A nova is a white dwarf that explodes. And I would like to suggest a talk on novae and T. Corona Borealis soon. Members of LAS, if you can think of something. I'll be gone. I'll be in Budapest next year. Kate Polinsky's here. I'm happy to talk to LAS, but no, for the community, T. Corbore is going to go nova after 80 years. And so that deserves a talk. So anyway, in our universe, it's hydrogen, helium, everything else, and carbon and oxygen are the main everything else's. That's why we have so much water. Now, we can make molecules with a little help if you have dust grains. Dust is made up of sticky, heavy elements like carbon and magnesium and iron that the stars spew them out. When two atoms meet, it takes a really high temperature to force them apart. A couple thousand Kelvin or more. 3,000, something like that. So these grains of carbon and iron and magnesium and silicon are sitting there, and then the gas molecule comes, attaches itself like hydrogen or like oxygen, and migrate around the surface with chemical forces called Van der Waals forces, join up, and then they float off. So dust, helps molecules form. That's why we find molecules in dusty clouds. Now, life. To quote the famous life scientist, Dr. Frankenstein, there is life. It's right here. Anywhere else? We're looking. But if you haven't seen this, this is a very good study, case study, in science from non-life, from non-life. But don't try it at home. And it does require a storm. So maybe we can try it tonight.
And a wind.
Yeah, so, life as we know it, it's made up of amino acids. We use 20. There are more, but there are 20 that are used on Earth. Any biology types here? Give me a few. I invited the University of Louisville Biology Department. So these amino acids are the basis of proteins. They work together. They're made up of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and a little R group could be some variable, maybe sulfur, phosphorus. So they form naturally from the most common molecules. That'll be water, methane, ammonia, and a little bit of energy, say light or spark or something like that. So that's why we have so much water, and actually why we find amino acids in meteorites and in interstellar gas clouds. Now, why is water the stuff of life? Think of the water of life here. If you can just get into the karma of this place. Water has some great attributes. First of all, it's polar. It has an oxygen and two hydrogens off to one side. So one side has a negative charge, oxygen. One side has a positive charge, it's a hydrogen. And so that helps to dissolve molecules. It is a great place for chemical reactions to happen. It also stays liquid over a pretty broad temperature range, at least on Earth pressure. It's all over the place, which you've seen. It holds heat well. You can heat liquid water and it'll stay liquid for a long time. It'll hold that heat and it'll cool off slowly, heat up slowly. It stabilizes things. So that's why, for example, Lake Erie is a great place to have vineyards. Nobody would think it. But the great vineyards of Ohio are because of Lake Erie, and also there's some in the Ohio Valley as well. Water also has a very interesting characteristic in that it expands when it freezes. That's not common. It's very rare, actually. It's why you can ice skate. It's why the surface of a lake freezes and the inside stays liquid. So if you have life and the surface freezes, it still can manage. If water froze from the bottom, then things that live in water would have a problem. It has a high surface tension, which makes it form globules, which is very nice because that probably has something to do with first cells forming. Water is also a greenhouse gas. Now, before you say, stop putting water in the atmosphere, there's nothing you can do to change that. Our oceans do it for us. It keeps us warm like a blanket. We would be, basically, if we had no greenhouse gases, and we didn't rotate, our day side would be like the moon, and our night side would be like the moon, which would be boiling point of water and easily 100 Celsius below. So water can be very good for cooling a planet which is a little bit farther from its star, so it expands what's called the habitable zone. So going over these points a little bit, it dissolves ions. So for example, salt separates the sodium and the chlorine atoms. If you have chlorine, that's negative. The hydrogens will go around it. If you have sodium, then the oxygens will go around it. So water is great for these, for taking apart atoms and then putting them together. Batteries and water. It stays liquid over a big range, which is very helpful. Although, if it gets to be too high pressure and too hot, it'll turn into this stuff, which is not quite gas, not quite vapor. Until you get to superionic water when it turns into a half solid, half liquid. It has very stable structure as a crystal, but this sliding structure as a liquid. So that's the stability for chemical bonds to have this sliding structure. For ice floating, What would happen if ice did not flow would be, instead of having cold, medium, warm water, and then and an ice skin on top of it, you have the ice flow forming the bottom, you'd only have a few inches on the top and it would thaw, the frozen lake. And also, water will expand slightly, just ever so slightly, when it warms up. So there's a constant churning, actually, in heated bodies of water. You'll get some heating from the surface layers, and then you'll have deeper layers that are affected by the bottom geography and so on, topography. And so you get churning and mixing of nutrients. It holds heat because it takes a lot of energy to turn it from a solid into liquid, and then to get the liquid up to a gas, and then to turn the gas into a gas. So you have to put a tremendous amount of energy into a chunk of ice to vaporize it. It's extremely stable. And actually, we use this in life when we sweat. Or we can radiate with capillary action. We come to that too. So it has a ton of very useful properties. As I mentioned, it moderates temperatures because it heats up slowly and cools off slowly. That's why the hottest month of the year is August, even though June is when the sun is directly overhead. And the coldest month of the year is February, even though December has the shortest day. Because the oceans take a long time to heat up and to cool off. Now, there are a couple of properties that help, especially with things like capillary action. So, water will stick to surfaces, and it has a surface tension. And put those together, and you get capillary action, which allows for flow. The tree doesn't have a heart. It relies on basically evaporation from the leaves, and then the water gradient to get water to go through up the tree from the ground. And it's also a greenhouse gas. There are others, like methane, ozone, carbon dioxide, and nitrous oxide. We have just the right mix for keeping things as they are, and changing it is probably not a good idea. The way it works is the sunlight hits the earth. The earth warms up, radiates infrared light because of its temperature. It's clear, transparent in optical wavelengths, but it's greenhouse gases are opaque in infrared wavelengths. And so this infrared radiation gets partially absorbed by this layer of greenhouse gases. Actually, it even happens in the lower part of the atmosphere. And then re-radiates in both directions, up and down. So it's like a partial leaky blanket. And that's why our temperature goes up by about 30 Kelvin or 30 Celsius. So, in conclusion, let's see how we're doing. Good time. About an hour. This is water under the bridge. I want you to think for a brief moment about some water near you. That it's really all over the place because of stars making oxygen and hydrogen from the data. This water, the hydrogen is 13 billion years old, and the oxygen is about 5 billion years old from some dead stars. So think about that. It's in you too. It's all over. It has some great characteristics for life. And so, again, after this talk, I want you to think about what you have in your hand. So that's it. Very happy for your time. James Webb was launched to pro-planetary observation. Nice to see that.
First of all,
the explosion might not be uniform in all directions. Stars can be lopsided, they can be spinning, they can be oblate, and then the explosion can start off-centered. Number one. Number two, the star is surrounded by gas that it had previously given off, which is lumpy. So it might be on a nebula sitting there, or it might be in a star cluster. So the gas between stars is not uniform. As a matter of fact, very few things in the universe are perfectly smooth. So you put an explosion into a lumpy gas, and you'll get a lumpy cloud of gas out of it.
Why is Virgos colder than
that is your PhD project. We don't know. But there is a proposal for Uranus, or there is the number one ranked proposal for what's called the Decadal Survey for Planetary Science for NASA, the NSF, 2020. I hope it gets funded because it has to be launched around 2032 to take advantage of the gravity assist of Jupiter to drop by 2045. If we don't make 2032, we wait another 11 years. The chances to go to Uranus on the cheap with a gravity assist are few and far between. We want to make what's called the Uranus Orbiter and Probe, atmospheric probe. We need that. We flew by once in 1986. The spacecraft was built in the 70s. Does anybody have a car from the 1970s? Okay. Can you imagine what a camera and computer from the 1970s are like? At the time, that was the best we could do. But we can do a lot better now. So please do research on the outer planets, because I want to know what the answer is. And you'll have job security if you fed on a space mission to the outer planets.
Is it colder than
the snow that No. It's something inside. It's a structure problem. Something is different. We had a brief look. And sorry to say, sometimes we don't know.
What frequencies are light is it going to see?
From about red optical light to the eyes, that's an excellent. To about 55 microns, which is 100 times longer than the human eye can see.
So is that atmosphere visible light?
6,000 meters per second. By the way, I want to congratulate you tonight in San Antonio. There's a gathering like this, and tomorrow in Hawaii, there's going to be a gathering like this. This is something that many people do. That's a good thing. If you come to Hungary.
Series because one, almost there are many different clay minerals. They're mm-hmm. almost all produced by chemical weathering or felsic like minerals. Mm-hmm. Most common is lowest rank clay, kaolinite. Why is it there? Is it kaolinite? And
I don't
how
think
do they know that it's there at that level?
I don't think so. I was quoting the article. We know Mars is clay too.
Yeah.
Spectroscopy of various bombs. I don't know, I can look into it. Make emails with me, look for the article. But the Dawn mission.
Because it's on the subsurface.
Well, we get the spectrum from the surface. So
but
there are things turned
up
craters. You can smash on these with the spectrum from up there.
Yeah, thanks for coming out tonight. We have one more presentation for the season, Dr. Peter Litzy from